Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to the New Books Network and this podcast channel of Christian Studies. I'm Justin McGeary. I am one of the hosts of this channel. Today, we will be talking about the book, Transatlantic Religion, Europe, America, and the Making of Modern Christianity, published by Brill Press, a fascinating, wide-ranging group of essays that focuses on the 19th century connections between Europe and America that aims to show how these transatlantic exchanges played a crucial and substantially unexplored role in the shaping of American religious life. Religious historian Mark Knoll, in the foreword, says that this book demonstrates better than any other single volume to date how very important for the history of Christianity in the United States those connections, links, and relationships between America and Europe have been. And today with me are the editors, Annette Aubert and Zachary Purvis. So Annette and Zach, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Yeah, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, and I'm looking forward to our conversation together. I think the book is really interesting. And before we actually dive into the book, maybe you could just share a little bit about yourself, a little bit about your background. Annette, would you kick us off?
Sure. I'm a historian of religion and lecturer at a graduate school in Philadelphia. My academic specialty is 19th century Protestant transatlantic religion, and my book entitled The German Roots of 19th Century American Theology was published by Oxford University Press, and I previously served as a fellow at the Craig Center. My research interests range from intellectual history and historical and transatlantic studies to American and German religious studies.
Yeah, thank you. Zach, how about yourself?
Yeah, I teach mostly church history at Edinburgh Theological Seminary. Had a few different appointments before this. I was at the University of Edinburgh and also the University of Göttingen, University of Wisconsin-Madison. So sort of like the characters in the book, have felt the transatlantic experience acutely. I work mostly similar to Annette on sort of history of theology in the modern period in the 19th century, but also do some Reformation studies and sort of the reception of the Reformation traditions.
Wonderful. Yeah. And yeah, both of your volumes are very interesting and well worth the read. And being that you're both kind of not only scholars of the transatlantic kind of historical approach as well as living it, maybe that's where we could kick things off. So how is this, the approach to transatlantic religion different from previous histories of American religion as far as the context for thinking about American religion? Where do you see your current, this current volume fitting?
Yeah, even though 19th century cross-border connections were common, standard histories of American religion have generally been limited to national contexts, specifically the importance of religion to nation building and Americans' religious exceptionalism. A smaller number of works explored transatlantic religious relationships in terms of German influences via the Lutheran and Moravian churches, pietism, and the transatlantic culture of revivalism. So the number of books emphasizing this narrow approach in 19th century American religious history has resulted in a tendency toward highlighting frontier upheavals, westward expansion, and the influence of Anglo-Atlantic relations, which in turn emphasizes the culture of revivalism and specific philosophies such as common sense realism. Such studies have often overlooked that beginning in the revolutionary period and continuing throughout the 19th century, American religious figures were in frequent and in ongoing dialogue with Europeans. As our book shows, Americans borrowed many European ideas, and thanks to the many travelers and immigrants who moved between European countries and the US, there emerged a transatlantic movement of ideas. So what happened, this narrow approach means that many important aspects of regarding the creation of American religion have been overlooked or underemphasized. And two factors are particularly striking. The first associated with the challenges of reading different languages such as German, Dutch, Danish, French, and Italian. And the second is the perception of American exceptionalism that emphasized separation from European geography, ideology, politics, and lifestyles during the 18th and 19th centuries.
Yeah, so Zach, is there anything you would add to where the volume particularly fits?
Well, I think there's a very full, excellent answer by Annette that I would second heartily. Also, I think that as how we thought about the volume and put it together, we were keen of bigger sort of paradigm shifts going on in historiography. And one of those is certainly the international turn, moving beyond just national borders. And so I'm sure we'll get into in more detail the different approaches that we discuss in terms of entangled history and cultural transfer and those sorts of things. But we were keen to find a lens, a transatlantic lens, as we've put it in the book, that takes account of those different realities, the different sort of connections that a diverse group of American thinkers and institutions and peoples and so on and so forth had with Europeans across the board. And so I'd say just that international perspective is also something that we were keen to imbue the book with, and that I think makes it stand out in some respect.
I would like to add something about the entangled history, which is an important aspect. As transatlantic history emerged as a discipline based on the observation that developments in Europe and North America were closely entangled, therefore, any profound understanding requires an assessment of a common story. Our book uses an entangled history approach that is considered an essential concept in transcultural relationship studies. Entangled history invites reassessments of relationships among various societies and cultures. Critical assessments of older historical approaches to comparative history encourage scholars to develop an alternative referred to as entangled or connected history. Entangled history traces connections between ideas and individuals who move across national boundaries. In other words, it emphasizes the interconnectedness of societies as its fundamental point of departure. Its core principle is that individual nations cannot function as a singular units of historiography because they exert their effects through interaction and dialogue. Our book in particular focuses on the transatlantic history premise that emphasizes the consideration of networks and agent connections.
Yeah, and so you break the book essentially into two parts, education and the establishment of new networks, and then different developments, and it seems to me developments, theological, cultural, political. And it seems to me that kind of the entangled nature actually makes it somewhat hard at times to organize, I guess. But maybe you could just explain how you organize the project. You break it into these two parts. How did that come about? Was it challenging? Because there's a lot of overlap of figures and people and ideas throughout.
Sure. I think you're right. In one sense, it's good to admit that those categories are maybe arbitrary is perhaps too strong, but you're right that figures like Philip Schoff and many others sort of freely, wildly transgress these tidy little divisions, and they do reappear in different chapters. Or just looking at the book again, I see we have a great chapter by Mike Shea on Anglophone sort of missionary initiatives towards Roman Catholics and Anglicans in Rome. And that appears in the second half of the book on sort of theological, cultural, political developments. It could very well have been placed in the first half. So these seem to be prominent categories that arose from the material as we looked at the experience of sort of 19th century religious history and also the particular aims and theses that appeared in the chapters that we received from our contributors. But I think it does point to the prominence of these networks and this sort of entangled approach that really is the foundation for so many of the other developments that do take place. I think it also is helpful to spotlight, as it were, some of these. I think it's helpful to spotlight some of these networks that do appear in the first half of the book. So, the rise of new forms of communication, new forms of travel, which aided the building of new institutions, personal contacts on a formal and informal basis. And all of these things, I think, have a very important part to play in these more particular doctrinal or cultural or theological / political questions that appear in the second half of the book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it's maybe there's a few prominent figures that recur, especially August Tulloch and Philip Schoff a number of times, as well as a few others, maybe less prominently than those two. But Annette, maybe you could say something about those two. What do they reveal kind of about the transatlantic world and the American religious life?
Yeah, August Tulloch was an important German Protestant biblical scholar. He was associated with the Awakening movement who influenced the transatlantic religious world. He was profoundly influencing also the revival of evangelical learning and academic learning in opposition to Enlightenment rationalism in Germany. He had an important influence on 19th century American religious history. I think the most direct and important exchanges and influence between Americans and Tulloch occurred at the University of Halle, where Tulloch welcomed many international students. Tulloch considered his American students with more than ordinary interest and was in the habit of calling a number of those his special pets. So he was especially close to American students like Edward Robinson and Charles Hodge, many of his American students became key members of a transatlantic network who translated some of his work into English and who advocated biblical literature in America. So what happened among American evangelical scholars, they relied on Tullock as a guide for critical scholarship. A review of the American Protestant literature of the time shows that Tullock became for Americans a trusted and expert guide for understanding difficult German religious developments, and in particular what was known as the rationalistic controversy. His influence was not only thanks to his scholarly skills, but also his success as a mediating figure, for he attempted to create a balance between traditional Protestantism and modern science in a post-Enlightenment context. In particular, we can see that a pragmatic trend of the American mind, similar to active piety, forged a natural bridge between Americans and Tullock. And besides that, Tullock appealed to Americans from different religious backgrounds. He became, as is seen in our book, an intellectual mentor to Lutherans, Baptists, Congregationalists, and even Unitarians. So his positive reception among such a large and mixed group is best explained by his pietistically oriented mediating approach.
Yeah, you see that come out in David Conline's article over whether Tullock was a universalist. You see all these Americans fighting over whether Tullock was on their side. And such an interesting shows kind of his incredible prominence.
Yeah, it turns out that Tullock became an intellectual hero to quite a diverse group of Americans who could draw on his different views.
Yeah. And what about Schaff? I mean, he shows up in a few essays and, of course, maybe is one of the most well-known figures from the whole volume to an American audience of religious history in particular.
The immigrant scholar Philip Schaff was an important transatlantic figure who made significant contributions to American religious studies. He was born in Switzerland and studied in Germany and moved to America in 1844, but maintained close ties with his European peers and communicated regularly with his German professors. As a faculty member at a Reformed seminary in Mercersburg and later at Union Seminary in New York, he acted as a bridge builder between German and American ideas. When he arrived in the U.S., very few seminary curriculums offered classes in the same way as in German universities. Schaff was surprised to learn that the outdated church history text written by Johann Mosheim still served as a primary textbook in American seminaries. This motivated him to promote several ideas that were being debated in German universities at the time, and he encouraged serious church history scholarship in the same way that he was trained in Germany, and became a mentor to American researchers. Our book treats him as an exceptional, influential transatlantic figure.
Yeah, and Elizabeth Clark's article showing Schaff's relationship with the American Arthur McGifford in a mentoring relationship, I think, really draws out quite well Schaff sending an American over to study in Europe and then kind of guiding him through that world and helping him then come back to the United States and have quite a significant influence himself as a church history scholar. And one of the other articles that was quite interesting was Michael Shea's article, he spends a bit of time on the importance of kind of the informal networks. Is there something we could say about some of the other figures, other networks that appear in these essays? Zach, perhaps, would you want to tackle that?
Sure. I think, Mike's essay, Mike Shea's that you mentioned, that we've referred to here on sort of missionary activities in Rome is very dense. And so it's somewhat hard to discuss all the names that he mentions, but I think he does bring a very helpful approach, one that he's picking up on things that other scholars have done in regard to the Oxford movement. So this movement that arises from Oxford in some sense in the first third or so, the 1830s and thereabouts, within the Church of England, but to look at the fact that there really were Oxford movements, plural, and so it's not just one figure. And so he brings this maybe more differentiated approach to some of those discussions as he talks about missionary initiatives, which I think sheds new light on that terrain. And another sort of network, we might say, or relationship or something that's been recast in the volume is also sort of someone like George Bancroft. Bancroft was this decorated Harvard historian and politician, and one picture has sort of emerged when scholars look at what he said he was up to when he went abroad to Europe, in particular to Germany to study, when he wrote back as to what he was up to his Harvard betters. But maybe another picture emerges when one looks, as Paul Carey did in his chapter in the book, at Bancroft's journal entries and lecture notes and other sort of student material that he produced and generated. And so the two portraits don't always line up. And so I think it's one really interesting case where looking at new sources sheds in some ways significant new light on our view of and understanding of somebody like Bancroft or some of these other important figures.
Yeah. I think that the picture that is provided by a number of these essays is how well connected a number of these figures are, that are often kind of treated either in isolation or just within their own national boundaries. And so one of the things that you note in the book is how often really much of American religious historiography has been limited to America, as far as focusing on, usually the frontier, or sometimes if there is the connection back to Europe, it's usually in the Anglo-American connection. Maybe could you say a little bit about some of the other countries that emerged? What are some of the connections? Germany is quite prominent, but you also have chapters that show connections back with the Netherlands, with Denmark, with France. Annette, would you want to hit on a few of those countries? And Zach, maybe you as well.
Yeah, I would like to start actually with Germany. German historians were particularly interested in exploring the German education system's influence on America, all the way from nursery schools to universities. For example, Jürgen Herbst's pioneering research shows how the German concept of Wissenschaft shaped American higher education. Despite all this research into Germany's influence, few scholars have engaged with academic and religious networks between 19th century European and American Protestant and Catholic figures. So the question is, why Germany and not Oxford? Leading 19th century evangelical academics in the US understood their shortcomings in scientific work in several disciplines and therefore welcomed the texts and ideas coming out of German universities for use as models for their own biblical scholarship, as well as for research into church history and dogmatics. American professors became heavily reliant on German texts, and by 1825, fluency in the German language was a requirement for doing academic work in the US. Many American students viewed attendance at a German university as indispensable for their academic vocations. Therefore, German divinity studies became very influential in American universities and seminaries. As our book shows, there are some other countries that play an important role. Maybe Zach can say something about the other countries.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Sure. I think some other sort of relationships that are uncovered and discussed in the book include, in one of the final chapters, Timothy's chapter on France and the U.S. offers an intriguing look at, in one sense, the narrow question of establishment or disestablishment of the church vis-a-vis the state, but really is a much kind of broader look at how to conceive church-state relations. So he uncovers all kinds of interesting material looking at conversations that were had between various French theologians at the beginning of the 20th century with this landmark 1905 law codifying a separation of church and state in France with various theologians and church figures in America and sort of the French theologians often looked at the United States as something as a test case for thinking about the separation of church and state and what that would do to politics, but also to the religious vitality, we might say, of the state. And so he traces correspondence and other means of communication between figures like Cardinal Gibbons in Baltimore and the French Protestant theologian Paul Sabatier in Paris. Another sort of connection that is sometimes commented upon, but still perhaps there's more work to do there, is Denmark and the United States. Of course, there's various immigration patterns to discuss, but in the chapter by Lee Barrett, he goes to great length to discuss the reception of a figure like Hans Lassen Martinsen, an important Danish theologian in the 19th century, among what's sometimes called the Mercersburg School of Theology. Figures like Schaff and others there in Mercersburg read someone like Martinsen in German translation, not in Danish, but nevertheless, that represents an important influence, sort of mediating forms of Hegelian philosophy to them and got them into various controversies along the way. Annette is well placed to talk about some of those particular things, having worked on figures like Immanuel Gerhardt and others. But I think the interesting thing is that it's not just a sort of English or Scottish connection that holds across the Atlantic with the United States, but that there are a host of other countries that belong in this important conversation, sort of states in Scandinavia, but also Europe proper, Germany, France, and elsewhere, which together provide, I think, a more accurate description of how these theological developments and networks that we've been discussing, how they arise and what they accomplish.
Yeah, and even, you know, one of the things that comes out in Elizabeth Clark's article, just focusing on the American Arthur McGifford, is how much he travels Europe himself, spending times in the different libraries, and then he'll ultimately come back having really traveled quite extensively, you know, and then the process, so to speak, continues. Now, one of the other things that you note in the book is that so often American religious history focuses on Protestantism, and that your volume kind of does try to provide some maybe correction or counterbalance to that by looking at transatlantic Catholicism. Is there something you'd like to say? There's a few articles that hit on this. The article by Charlotte Hanson on Lord John Acton, Michael Shea's article, which we've already mentioned, and Zach, you have mentioned the article by Timothy Verhoeven. Is there anything else as far as transatlantic Catholicism that you'd like to make mention of?
Sure. I think we don't want to in any way sort of deny the real tremendous value that there is in so many of the sort of single confessional histories, we might say, in the sense of a Protestant story about a denomination or a movement or something like that in the United States in the modern period. But what we were keen to do is to broaden the picture somewhat, to say that in some cases, interesting things might be learned when we take kind of a multi-confessional approach. So if we had room to do a bigger book, we might have been able to include other voices and traditions as well. But it's interesting to see that something can be learned from the kind of transatlantic Catholic perspective when thinking about Protestant history and vice versa. I mean, the chapter on the 1905 French law shows that, I think, rather well, that here are these conversations that are happening across confessional boundaries in many regards. And so I think historians sometimes have to be careful not to artificially impose confessional boundaries on the historical material. Certainly there is room to look at confessional perspectives, but we should also be sensitive to broader discussions that might have been taking place in the period under view.
I think that, yeah, there's a number of ways that, in Michael, is it Michael? No, it's Verhoeven's article. He shows that there's also even conversation happening across the denominational lines as well. So it's definitely, I think, kind of a rich picture. Now, one of the other things that is you mention is sources. How do you find the historians in this volume are looking at sources either differently or new sources? What sort of things are they, where are they going that's also kind of maybe enhancing the picture that we have of both transatlantic history as well as American religion?
Yeah, the book references a large number of previously unexamined print and non-print materials. These new sources, especially those located in historical archives, support an understanding of new concepts regarding transatlantic influences in the development of religious studies in America. They also help clarify the influences of ecumenical religious journalism, academic religious mentoring, changes in scientific investigations, and institutional goals.
Yeah, I just I think that's exactly right. Just maybe a couple of examples that are interesting as well to think about. We mentioned, for instance, Paul Carey's chapter on Bancroft is sort of one of the first to actually dig into the Bancroft papers and look at lecture notes, whereas other scholars had often simply relied on correspondence, which is already an improvement from past scholarship that sometimes settled only for published records. Some other interesting cases, another one that Justin, you mentioned a moment ago, was Liz Clark's chapter on the mentoring relationship between Schaff and McGifford. We're very grateful for Liz's contribution. I think it was one of the last pieces that she wrote before her sad death. So we're very excited that that's in the volume, and it just stands out as a monument to her tremendous work as a scholar. But uncovering this rich correspondence between Schaff and McGifford through really a remarkable amount of archival study that she did, which is a recurring theme in here. I think good history is really written from the archives, and I think all of our contributors bear that out richly.
Yeah, yeah. What, as you were editing this volume, I'm just curious as to, both of you have tended to, your own work has focused particularly on the transatlantic connection between America and Germany. But as you were editing this volume, what was, in your own sense, what emerged, what kind of picture did you feel like your own understanding of this approach to history, what happened in the editing of the volume for you?
Yeah, bringing together the various chapters revealed that there were different influences at work shaping American religion during the 19th century, and it clearly revealed that more research needs to be done.
Yeah, I think that I would also just echo what Annette has said, that this certainly is not the final word, but I think it's an important first or second word on the topic, that what really became clear to us and to me working on the project was these different streams of influence. And I think Hartmut Lehmann, who contributed a wonderful epilogue to the end of the volume, nudges that conversation forward in an important way, suggesting future itineraries for this conversation to take. He talks about sort of pluralization needs to be an important factor, globalization, secularization. Each of these three concepts is really critical and really do emerge in the volume, but so much more could be done to show this rich and diverse and differentiated picture that emerges. So just for example, the globalization, I think we're able to establish the importance of a strong and dynamic transatlantic connection between, as past scholars have said, the old world and the new, and done that in a number of interesting ways. But one of the things that would be helpful and intriguing to do going forward would be to even broaden that picture, to say that it needs to be extended to actors in other parts of the world as well. So just as the U.S. is not only in conversation with Europe and vice versa, they're in conversation with other figures elsewhere. And so those discussions might play a prominent role, even in revising our transatlantic picture, and, of course, in the picture of 19th century American religious history also. So I think what emerges is really this picture of a remarkable number of influences, things that we haven't always paid careful attention to, things like new magazines that arise or new newspaper movements, as Andrew Close discusses, or how steam travel really did make it possible for so many students to go abroad and study and return and bring with them all sorts of ideas and experiences. And so bringing all of those things together into a more sort of multicolored picture, I suppose, one that's not just black, white, or gray, is really something that we learned from this project.
Yeah. Well, it's a wonderful book. I think that the narrative in the different chapters is great. There's some methodological considerations. There's a lot here in this volume. So thank you very much for your work on this. We have taken a good bit of your time, and I guess I'd just be curious. Do you have a current project or upcoming projects that we can be looking for, Annette, and then Zach, maybe?
Yeah, I'm continuing my work on the topic of transatlantic academic relationships.
Yeah, thanks for that, Justin. I've been working on a project that shifts gears slightly, although it does connect in some ways, which is on sort of the long-term reception of Philip Melanchthon. So thinking about Reformation history in central Germany and the first half and middle years of the 16th century. But there are various publishing endeavors that arise, reprinting his works and so on and so forth in the modern period that connect with some of the figures discussed in our volume. So that's what I'm up to.
Well, I definitely look forward to seeing more of your work in the upcoming future. And thank you so much for giving us some of your time. It was a pleasure talking with you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. It's a great pleasure to be here.
Yeah, thank you. It has been a great pleasure to be here.